Appeals is now in session. Judge Bjorkman, Judge Jessen, Judge Bretkel, the Honorable Louise Delford Bjorkman presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is July 24th, 2019. The first case on our calendar for oral argument is the matter of Christy Ann Ryan versus Jeffrey Allen Ryan. Counsel, we have prepared by reading your briefs, but you each will have 15 minutes for oral argument. Please note the timing on the podium. The podium can be raised and lowered depending on your needs, and it's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument. With that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mark Olson, and I'm here representing the appellant, Christy Ryan. This appeal involves a number of issues and cross appeal, I should say. Primarily, issues raised by my client are monetary in nature and involve what we deem to be actual erroneous determinations of fact by the trial court, as well as erroneous analysis of those facts. To overcome the presumption that property is marital, a party must demonstrate by a preponderance of the evidence the property is non-marital. That can be done either by a testimony of a party, by physical evidence, or by whatever evidence the court deems is sufficient to make those determinations. We take issue with the trial court's determination of all but one of the respondent, Jeffrey Ryan's, non-marital claims in the underlying matter, that being a $20,000 reduction in the original principal on the original mortgage on the property.
And that was the inheritance?
That was the inheritance.
Which was sort of the flip side of wife's had received a similar inheritance that was applied to the mortgage on that homestead, correct?
Correct. The wife's inheritance was $28,000, and neither party disputed that those contributions were, in fact, non-marital.
But other than that, most of the claimed non-maritable interests were, I use the word proven loosely, were supported by testimony, not documentary evidence. Is that fair to say?
Well, we take issue with that. I mean, the law says that testimony can support a non-marital claim. However, the law also, in certain respects, requires more than simply a statement of fact. For instance, with regard to the worker compensation settlement, Mr. Ryan produced nothing breaking down what portions of the settlement were for pain and suffering, for permanent disability, wage loss, economic loss, so on and so forth. And case law makes it clear, in order to make a non-marital claim with a work comp benefit, the party seeking the benefit to be treated as a non-marital claim has that burden of showing exactly what components are comprised in that work comp settlement. And as noted in the Ward case, it was a simple matter for Mr. Ryan's attorney to have presented evidence as to what the work comp claim constituted, what elements were in there. I would note that the settlement agreement is a lengthy settlement agreement, but it is basically a boilerplate settlement agreement that you see in any work comp case.
But isn't it true that the injuries from which the global settlement flowed predated with the exception of one exacerbation, predated the marriage, didn't they?
Not entirely. There were injuries that dated back to the 90s, but in each event, there was a trial exhibit that was submitted actually by Mr. Ryan's counsel where the employer characterizes these injuries as not being permanent in nature, as being temporary in nature, as not being ongoing, and that we're fully compensated for at the time of the individual injuries. The injury that occurred in 2011 was during the marriage, and it was an injury that basically ended Mr. Ryan's career for all practical purposes. He never worked again after that date. There was no medical evidence introduced by Mr. Ryan demonstrating a breakdown of how each of these particular prior claims affected the ultimate injury which was different in nature, I would note, than the previous injuries. I think one of the previous injuries was a knee injury or something to that effect, and the ultimate injury had something to do with his back and neck. So he produced no evidence with regard to not only how the ultimate settlement was fashioned and arrived at, and I would note that that settlement agreement does mention a laundry list of potential areas that the compensation could be for, but it didn't break down what it was for. And it also mentioned all the previous claims Mr. Ryan made, and specifically noted that those, excuse me. Specifically noted that all those claims were disputed and were paid in full, and that none of them were permanent in nature.
So when you talk about the workers' comp funds, I see a difference between that and kind of the 401k funds. So there, you're right. I mean, it was testimony, but it was more than just testimony saying this is non-marital. There, Mr. Ryan did, as I understand the record, testified this is the value of the fund in 2008. This is the value of the fund in 2015. Why isn't that testimony specific enough to at least on, you know, on that matter, support the district court's determination?
Well, we can see that that's the weakest of our arguments.
Okay.
That's why that argument was addressed at the end of the brief and not at the beginning of the brief. True, if you look at the purchase money that was used for the cabin, There is no dispute over the fact that there was a considerable amount of money in that 401k. The point of contention was, again, Mr. Ryan made no effort to really trace anything. He just simply said he did it. And that was the problem throughout this case. He just said he did certain things or was entitled to certain monies without taking the extra step and demonstrating what is needed.
Isn't it fair to say that to some extent went both ways when it came to the homestead? And I confess, I've tried to reconcile the district court's math, if you will, with respect to the homestead and its fair market value and the respective marital and non-marital interests of the parties, and I keep getting confused. As I understand the record, your client didn't present evidence of the fair market value of the home at the time of the marriage. So, again, there was some need by the district court to sort of guesstimate on some of that stuff. Isn't that true?
Well, there really wasn't, because that exercise wasn't needed. And the court didn't need to guesstimate anything because the parties stipulated and the court accepted the value of $280,000. When the court was called...
Right, but there has to be a comparison, does there not, to decide the marital interest and the increase in the value of the home and what percentage of that increase was marital versus non-marital?
Well, we broke down four different ways you could look at the calculation, and the percentages in my client's favor range anywhere from 83% to 87%. But for what we contend is a mathematical error by the judge, it should have been 85% without regard to the value at the time of the marriage or anything, because the judge made a factual determination of what my client's non-marital component in that $280,000 was, and I think it was $218,400 or something. That's a factual determination. There is support in the record for it by looking at my client's initial contribution of $156,000 towards the purchase of the home back in 1995 or whatever year that was. And then there are the $28,000 non-marital contribution that the judge added onto that number, and then he added some other things together. We are not taking issue with that $218,400 on appeal.
Well, but the numbers he adds up end up being more than $280,000. That's the problem I've got with that whole. Error somewhere there, isn't there?
There is error there, and the respondent conceded that at the at the post-trial motion, and the judge just kind of threw up his hands. And I think what happened here. Neither counselor nor I tried the underlying case, is the judge was frustrated with the lack of evidence that was being presented, largely by Mr. Ryan. Mr. Ryan's lack of cooperation in the discovery process.
So are you asking this court, in a sense, to fix the math error, or? I mean, you're seeking relief on the money, you know, the property division. So how can we do that as an appellate court?
Easily. We're asking for a reversal and remand to the trial court to recalculate the percentages as far as the future distribution of the monies in the from the sale of the homestead sometime in the future, with the directive that the value is 280 as determined, that my client's non-marital interest is the 218.4 as determined, not challenged, that Mr. Ryan's non-marital contribution is 20,000 that wasn't challenged. So in effect, what you do is if you add the 20,000 to the 218, you're going to end up with about $61,000 or somewhere around there. That's marital. You divide it in two. So you direct the trial court to correct its mathematical error, because we don't know where this extra $48,000 even came from. It's not clear from the judge's determination. And when the issue was raised post-trial, he gave no explanation for it. He just kind of threw up his hands like, you know, I'm done with this case. So it's a simple exercise. And that 85%, by the way, falls right in the middle of the 83 to 87 that we contend would be appropriate methods of making a determination of the appropriate division of the asset itself. So, again, it's not contingent on what the value of the property was at the time of the marriage. What it is contingent on is the non-marital claims of the parties, and we know those. The judge said 218.4 with my client and 20,000 with Mr. Ryan. The judge accepted the 280 on the record as far as the appraised value. It was done by a certified appraiser. Parties both agreed that it was an appropriate number. So our position is it's an easy fix to take care of that issue. With regard to the Social Security disability distributions that were made, the trial court treated them all as non-marital. That's contrary to the law. The Social Security Administration defines the benefits paid out as for wage loss. And with regard to a minor child, the same can be said. It's monies paid out for the benefit of the minor child. But the court gave the entirety of the Social Security distributions to Mr. Ryan. And again, we contend that is error as a matter of law. Mr. Ryan, from what I can tell on the record, presented no evidence that would support anything other than it's a marital asset, not a non-marital asset that the court ended up making a determination it was.
Speaking of error, I want to turn your attention, in the moments you have remaining, to the issue of parenting time. And Mr. Ryan argues that the failure to award at least 25% of the parenting time to him is a legal error that requires reversal. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think that has to be raised as an issue, number one, at the trial court level. There was no argument that Mr. Ryan was looking for the presumptive 25%.
Well, didn't he want equal parenting time? Isn't that what he was asking for?
He asked for equal parenting time, but that's a different request than what the statute states as a presumption. And again, it is a presumption and it's rebuttable. That being said, even if it were a legal issue for this court, the statute itself breaks down how the court can look at 25%. It can look at overnights, or it can look at just the cumulative amount of time that one of the parents has. And Mr. Ryan has the child from 9 o'clock in the morning every day of the week until 4:30 in the afternoon. And he has the alternating weekends. On top of that, he's got more than 25% of the parenting time right now, even without the court designating the 25% figure. So there was no error of law here that needs to be corrected by this court, and it's really a non-issue from our standpoint, because Mr. Ryan was awarded substantial parenting time. He didn't get his 50-50 parenting time that he was asking for good reason. I mean, the trial court made many detailed findings in support of why it awarded my client the predominant amount of the overnights and the quote-unquote physical custody of the minor child. So we don't see the 25% as an issue. And if there are no other questions?
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Adam Blonick, and I represent the respondent, Jeffrey Ryan, in this matter. And what Mr. Ryan is requesting the court to take action on is a remand and reversal of the issue of physical custody. The trial court awarded sole physical custody to Ms. Ryan. We're asking that joint physical custody was more appropriate, and the issue of parenting time, as counsel addressed and as the referenced by the court here, that Mr. Ryan did not get the presumptive minimum 25% parenting time.
Did he make that argument either during the trial or in the context of the post-trial motion?
As the court just questioned, he requested an equal parenting time schedule. Actually, he was asking for greater than equal parenting time schedule. In the post-trial submissions, his counsel at the time requested it, what we call a 5-2-2-5 schedule. One parent having Monday and Tuesday, the other having Wednesday and Thursday, and alternating every other weekend from Friday through Monday morning.
Mr. Blonick, if I may, would you agree that if we looked at parenting time cumulatively across the course of a year, that your client gets 25% of the parenting time?
No, I don't. To reference the statute, that's Minnesota Statute 518.175G, where it references the counting of the overnights. Specifically, it says the percentage of parenting time may be determined by calculating the number of overnights that a child spends with a parent or by using a method other than overnights if the parent has significant time periods on separate days when the child is in the parent's physical custody but does not stay overnight.
And you're saying that second way of calculating isn't this cumulative approach that counsel for appellant referred to?
Yeah, well, one, I would say just by the clear language of that statute and the fact that Ms. Ryan has sole physical custody. He never has physical custody of his child. He has parenting time, but the statute specifically says physical custody. He never has physical custody. So I think if you're reading the black and white letter of the statute, it's only overnights that you would look at. During the summer, if we were to look beyond that, during the summer, he has some more time during the day because the child isn't in school, but during the school year, which is 9 months out of the 12, it's literally just a little bit of time before school, a little bit of time after school. Basically, Mr. Ryan gets the child on the bus, gets the child off the bus into Ms. Ryan. So I would say he's not, that the 25% is not met, and he did, in fact, assert the 25%.
Don't you have to actually cite the statute to preserve that issue of the rebuttable presumption?
As indicated in his brief, it would. Well, and I don't think so. But if he was to do that, it really marginalizes his position on custody and parenting time. If he's asking the court, please give me at least 25% when he's asking for equal parenting time or during the trial, he was actually initially asking for sole physical custody. And so from an argument standpoint, from a trial position, for him to say, yeah, but please at least give me 25%, I think, like I said, marginalized his position. And I don't read that. I don't necessarily read that in the statute. I just read as long as he asserts something greater than 25% that he's met his prerequisite in the statute, Your Honor. The parenting time schedule itself, is a lot of back and forth, as I just stated, with Ms. Ryan dropping the child off in the morning, with Ms. Ryan during the day, back to Ms. Ryan. We don't believe that to be in the child's best interest with all those back and forths. Again, reason why I believe the schedule that Mr. Ryan requested at trial was the appropriate schedule.
But you agree that's an issue for the district court, and we just review for abuse of discretion.
I agree, and I also would acknowledge that this issue was not raised on a motion for amended findings and new trials, so the scope is narrow here. but that the court looks at any substantive legal issues or whether the evidence supports the findings or the findings can support the conclusions of law. But I do see that as a significant issue. But I believe the main legal issue on the parenting time schedule is the presumptive 25% that he did not get. And if you're counting overnights, he's at 14%. On the custody, the physical custody label, I just want to reference also by definition, so it's Minnesota Statute 518.003 subdivision 3D that defines joint physical custody. And by definition, it means the routine daily care and control and residence of the child is structured between the parties. Here, the court did grant a parenting time schedule that involves the child in both parties' care every day during the week, every other weekend. This child is in the care of both parents on a daily basis. I would say by definition, what the court did was award joint physical custody by structuring this parenting time schedule the way it did. We're asking that Mr. Ryan get more parenting time, but based on what the court did and looking at the definition of joint physical custody, I see those aligning that this was in effect an award of joint physical custody, and that's what should have been awarded. The other issue just on Mr. Ryan's cross appeal was his interest in the marital home that was deferred until the child graduates from high school, so deferred about 10 years in the future.
Do you agree with the district court's assessment of the parties' respective non-marital interests, the percentages?
Do I agree with
that? Yeah.
I agree with you, Your Honor. It's very confusing. It's extremely confusing reading through the judgment and decree.
Well, it seems that the district court set percentages, gave, you know, Ms. Ryan 68% non-marital, Mr. Ryan 32%, but then added on to that the undisputed $28,000 that wife had contributed out of inheritance funding, and the $20,000 your client contributed, and somehow that then gets us this bigger number.
Correct. I readily agree there was a math error that the judge that the trial court judge made a math error in his computations, and in the reason why I included an actual balance sheet in my. My brief was because the trial court judge did not, neither of the attorneys did, and one, I needed that to reflect on just on the actual division of property and also to attempt to explain that to the court as well, what happened, and to see whether or not everything did add up and whether everything was equitable. I also take issue with many of the amounts, the awards, the workers' comp award, the Social Security disability lump sum payment.
Do you argue that wife should get none of that as opposed to the low percentages that were awarded?
No, the issue is that these were from well before the divorce trial. The workers' compensation award was from January of 2013, which was over 5 years prior to the divorce, that there was no evidence in trial that these funds even existed. In the bank statements that were provided in the exhibits, so there were no funds there. So the court, in effect, was dividing assets, dividing funds that didn't exist. And again, more reason why I needed to provide a balance sheet of, in reading through the judgment decree, trying to discern, okay, what did exist at the time of trial, and based on what existed, how these assets and liabilities were allocated.
But don't we have to take a look at this, because the court says that there are a number of things were bought with non-marital property, the AT, with everything from kind of the cabin to the ATV and the camp trailer. I can't remember them all. So don't we have to get to the bottom of this?
Correct. And again, was part of the balance sheet that I established in my respondent's brief. Admittedly, that got confusing as well to try to separate out the labels that the trial court put on these non-marital properties. And so what the goal was to establish when you actually do the math on how on the assets and liabilities that Mr. Ryan received or was ordered to pay and what Ms. Ryan received and was ordered to pay, it comes out that the non-marital awards basically weren't there. There wasn't any money left to actually award to Mr. Ryan. Was the issue. On the workers' compensation award itself, just to address that some, as the court referenced, there were injuries prior to the marriage, only one during the marriage. And in the stipulation, the workers' comp stipulation, it referenced the monthly payments of $236 and $16 per month that were projected over the life of Mr. Ryan. And so when you look at that was about 5 years prior to the divorce. About 14,000 of that would have been during the marriage, and the remainder would have been after the marriage.
But the final injury that disabled your client occurred during the marriage.
Correct. But there were other injuries that were referenced from prior to the marriage.
But he was working during the early years of the marriage, is my point. He was, despite those prior injuries and compensation payments, he was working during the marriage up until 2011 when...
Correct.
Okay.
Correct, yep. But he did not work the last approximately six years of the marriage. The Social Security disability lump sum payments also referenced in this appeal, the bulk of that was used to pay off the disability payments from Hartford. So he received as a lump sum, and so in December of 2015, also well before the divorce trial, for himself, back pay of $63,681.90. Of that, he had to immediately pay back Hartford for the disability payments of $55,040, and then he also paid the 2015 taxes associated with that, of 6,426 and $3,030. So when you deduct those out of the $63,681.90, you're actually at a negative number. So there was nothing there. The disability payments that he received, those were just monthly payments. It wasn't a lump sum payment. This wasn't some big award that was sitting in a bank account. It was just him having to pay back the monthly amounts that he received. So there was nothing there. What was left within was the payments for the party's child, Joey. The back pay was $35,976. There's testimony in trial of where that money went, but again, there weren't funds left when at the time of trial. The 401k funds, that was also referenced, and counsel also included that in his oral arguments, included in the trial exhibits that there was a balance in that account of $144,478. It was in July of 2010. It's close in time to the marriage itself, in that in Ms. Ryan's trial attorney submissions to the court, she acknowledged that that $14,185 of that would be marital, and basically the remainder was non-marital. In that same year, in 2016, the cabin was paid off. So we believe that Mr. Ryan did adequately trace those funds to the cabin.
If I may, because I had a question about the cabin, because the district court says the parties, in their findings, the parties agree respondent be awarded all right, title, and interest in the cabin. And looking at the record, it appears to me that appellant didn't agree to that, and yet the district court relies upon that. So don't we have to send it back and ask the district court to take another look?
Yeah, in reading through the transcript, the issue is brought up a a few times during the trial itself.
Do you agree that she never, on the record, agreed?
She said she would agree if she received the house free and clear.
Which she didn't.
Correct. So whether or not that requires the court to reverse it.
That's my question.
Yeah, correct. I don't think so. Yes, that may have been an error to state that they agreed, but if the math still works out with the division of marital assets and each party receiving their respective non-marital assets, I would contend that it's a harmless error to.
But we know the math doesn't work. I mean, I think everyone agrees that with respect to the homestead, there is a calculation problem.
Correct, but in the end, with the math, it comes out fairly even and equitable. Like I said, it's not even, it doesn't need to be even, the law doesn't require it to be even, but when you do the math, it does come out quite equal and equitable. And I believe I'm out of time.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Olson, you have the last word.
Just briefly, Your Honor, getting back to the homestead issue, again, it's fairly simple to tell the trial court, you don't add that $48,000 onto the 280 because you've already taken it into consideration. The 28 is part of the 218. The 20 comes out of the balance between the 218 and the 280. It doesn't get added onto the top. It comes out of the balance between those two numbers. And I think that's a point that the judge somehow missed or just didn't follow in the party's arguments. I want to make it clear that the respondent, Mr. Ryan, failed to preserve any issues for appeal other than those with regard to legal determinations that the court would have the right to correct. And therefore, what we're looking at here is, does the evidence support the findings and do the findings support the conclusions? And in our brief, we went through in detail all of the findings made by the trial court that supported the trial court's determination with regard to the custody, parenting time issues, and so on and so forth. The counsel indicates that there's no big deal here with regard to these numbers and the monies from the Social Security disability and whatnot because there's nothing there. Well, I take issue with that. Mr. Ryan purchased a $56,000 vehicle that he still owned at the time of trial, paid for it in cash. Mr. Ryan purchased all kinds of equipment, vehicles, made improvements to the cabin and so on and so forth that totaled tens of thousands of dollars. And presumably, those items were in existence at the time of trial.
Which is why the cabin had appreciated and was debt-free. I mean, that's your argument.
Correct. And also, the cabin was in existence at the time of trial. So what's happened to it since is not an issue for this court to make a determination of. With there is one other issue that we addressed in our brief that I didn't address in my initial arguments, and that's the missing money. There was evidence that my client was able to garner through her own efforts because she didn't get them timely in discovery or anything else in preparation of trial, where there are three cashier's checks Mr. Ryan had obtained that totaled $90,000. The court makes no mention of that in its findings.
Although the court does make a finding that neither, because I think both parties claimed dissipation, that the other had dissipated assets, correct? Well, and I think the district court made a finding in neither favor, that neither party had demonstrated the other had done such thing.
But there's an overlap because the court looked at the monies from the third mortgage and the fact that my client had, I think, $32,000, $33,000 worth of monies that she kept. Mr. Ryan kept the additional portion of approximately $40,000 that supposedly went to the cabin or somewhere, we don't know. And the court ordered that the parties pay those amounts of monies. So those monies are not dissipated. And as far as I understand, that is the only claim of dissipation against my client. And that involved that money from the mortgage that she's ordered to be responsible for. So we're looking at a lot of money that's missing. We're looking at a case where Mr. Ryan wasn't forthcoming on his non-marital claims, on his discovery responses, on document responses, and so on and so forth. And we deem it appropriate that this court reverse on that particular issue and ask the trial court to make specific findings regarding all those monies that are missing. There are other assets in existence at the time of trial as well that had substantial values. So if, in fact, the work comp monies and the Social Security disability monies are attributable to those assets are dividable. And one last thing on the Hartford insurance issue. The trial court determined that was non-marital. It's not. It's a disability payment, and the law says it's a marital asset. So the court erred there as well. So if there's a fallback argument that the Social Security money went to pay off the Hartford monies, it's still the same money. Thank you.
All right, thank you both. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. Next case scheduled for oral argument is State of Minnesota versus Terrence Hill.